Charles Dietrich's sanctuary for those fighting drug addiction had morphed in its first decade of existence. It expanded from helping those with substance issues to becoming a utopian community with a growing list of business assets and resources. With its leader running things like a corporation, Synanon residents soon found their every hour accounted for, but they had no idea what was in store for their own futures or the futures of their children. This week's episode is The Cult of Synanon, Part 2.
Fills with dread, probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed. You'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Hood.
I'm gonna kill you.
Well, it's part two.
We're back with Chucky D.
If you thought things were starting to get a little bad last time, well, like with any cult, once you start to unravel the little thread, it all just kind of comes apart pretty quickly after that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, you know, anything that's tax-free, you start to go, we're getting a lot of money and we don't have to pay taxes on it.
I've been meaning to talk to you about something.
Oh, what? We start the
Hear
church
me
of,
out.
The church.
Church of Sinisterhood. Now, we don't have to pay taxes anymore.
Done.
All of our research, I feel like we've already got a lot of followers.
Yeah. Shout out to everybody. Y'all want to be a part of this? Let us know. It sounds like it's a Michael Scott bankruptcy situation where you sort of declare it. It's funny, though, because this was back in the 70s. And as you all listen to this, see if you start to see some Jeff Divine Twin Flames parallels that start cropping up. Because my mom always says, ain't nothing new under the sun. Like, you think... We'd go, what were they doing back then with all this? But I bet if we dug back in the 30s or the 1860s or the 1820s, there was probably people who start like Urantia. Like, I don't love, but it's fascinating that as we cover these groups, you start to see parallels and you're like, oh, it's just the same shit, different day. But
I mean,
nevertheless, heinously damaging.
One might liken it to just religion, which has been around for a real long time.
Or so, even the zeros.
I don't think we got to go to Urantia to see parallels of a group with a leader. And everyone idolizes that leader and pays their dues and lives under their rule and reign. It's kind of how things have always gone. Just some are more out there than others, and some are more accepted just because that's what's been around the longest and what everybody's grown up on. But
longevity.
When you break it all down, they all stem from the same kind of ideologies.
And it's always a human at the bottom of it that's like taken and bastardized, whether in this case, a wonderful belief system of self-sufficiency taken from Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. And there's always a fucking guy. And this fucking guy is Charles Dietrich.
Yep, there's always a guy. Well, sometimes a lady.
Oh,
we've had Mother God.
Yeah.
We've had
Linda.
I was going to call her Barbara, and I was like, that doesn't seem right. Linda McGillis.
Oh, man.
Yeah, she's something else, too.
She's a Star-Lord,
but
I think we found.
But they're all the same. I mean, but when you look at it, like, they're all, they just have different words for the same things, and they just, it's like Taco Bell. You got five ingredients and 700 menu items because you just pair them a little bit differently, and then you market it like, what are you talking about? The cheesy five-layer burrito is completely different than the gorditas. I get notes from Tommy on this because that was just off the top of my head. And he should be like, by the way, gordita supremes have nothing to do with big burritos. But my point is, they're all the same. They just they market them a little bit differently, depending on the demographic they're trying to attract.
Much, you're right. And as we've talked our way through this, we've come back full circle. We already have a church. It's called the Bell House Supreme, and it exists. So
I forgot
we just
do.
What we need to do is register the Bell House Supreme as a 501c3, as a church, a nonprofit. We'll get it registered. So if you're on our Patreon, you already know about the the Bell House Supreme, which is the Taco Bell based cult that Tommy is the leader
also
of.
Also, the Bell House Supreme Court, which is the court that I rule over.
The Crunchwrap. You're the Crunchwrap Supreme Court,
and my jurisdiction is global. So between all of this, how are we not already a religion tax-exempt organization?
We're pretty close.
Yeah. We've got all the makings for it.
We're taking the revival show on the road. You're going to worship the moon with us as we're about to go on the road and do tent revivals like back in the day. Bring your friends and family down. We call it the Full Moon Energy Tour. But really, what is the difference in us and a revival that you would be having for like,
less
you want to hear the good word about the moon, mother?
Less snakes.
Yeah, no snakes.
More laughs is what I like to say.
Fewer full moon energy now with fewer snakes and more laughs.
We're not saying zero snakes. We're just saying fewer snakes than an evangelical tent revival would probably have.
Yes, yes, but just as much fun and sweating, honestly,
no,
if we're being honest about
us
on stage. Well, we're talking about our Full Moon Energy Tour, where we talk about the darker side of the moon. And as you all know, we are fixing to go on tour starting May 14th. We're starting off in St. Louis. We're going to Chicago, Milwaukee, Charlotte, Raleigh, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Toronto, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, San Diego, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and we're ending it here in Dallas. If you want to sign up for our tent revival, go to sinisterhood.com/live shows and get your tickets now. And keep those emails coming with weird shit to do in those cities, because they're great.
Say, thank you to everybody that sent in so many wonderful, weird suggestions. We take them all and we put them in a little document that we have. So we sincerely appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we hope we see some of y'all on the road. And someone who's not invited is Charles Dietrich. He, you know, he's...
Well, for several reasons.
Yes,
one
for
of them
several
is
reasons.
Dead. But if he was alive, he still wouldn't be invited.
No. If you want to wear overalls, you're allowed to wear overalls. I just don't want anyone to mandate that you wear overalls to our show. And we don't want any people that would mandate someone like that. So...
No. I always, this is a weird vulnerable admission.
Please.
I've always wished I was the type that looked cute in overalls. And it's just not for my body type.
No, when I wear overalls, I look like Fred Mertz from My Little Lucy. It's not great. The shape of my body changes. And I was like, I don't look like Fred Mertz every day. But in overalls, I look like Fred Mertz. I'm about to go fix a problem in the building. Like I'm a building super from the 1950s. Not a good look.
My bust is not what I would call overall appropriate in that, you know, it spills out over the side. So it looks like I'm wearing a bib or something. It's just not like how, but I have some friends that I'm like, you look so cute in overalls. And I bet they're really comfortable. So that was just a little... glimpse into, you know, I've been doing some meditation. I have a new therapist. We just went on an eye-opening journey.
Yeah, one of my friends weekend. Goes, you gonna talk about that on the air? I was like, yeah, probably. I did have therapy this morning and had to go, how was your weekend? And I was like, well, I did a psychedelic trip. And she was like, okay, tell me everything. I was like, all right.
Well, there were a lot of dogs.
Yeah. It was
none
good times.
Of them mine. but yeah, it was, we'll talk about that. Maybe more on Patreon. I don't know if it's
y'all are going to hit us on the 420 stream. We're having a live Q&A on 420 at 2 p.m. Central. So come to that. We'll give you a whole breakdown of our.
Yes, we'll talk about it. That'll be a good place to talk about
it. The nine chickens that showed up towards the end there. So yeah, 420 Saturday at 2 p.m. Central. Come on Patreon, patreon.com/sinister and join the live stream. And we'll give you the breakdown of our psychedelic trip in the
and
many
before you
ways.
Say, oh my gosh, were they sacrificing chickens? No.
No.
These were brought with a full coop to the woman's house we were at.
They'll be cared for.
Just for egg-laying purposes.
Yeah, they'll be cared
but
for.
They showed up in the middle of, you know, the peak of things, and it was something.
Yeah, well, speaking of peak of things, where we're picking up with our Synanon story is at the peak of their... flitting and a getting. They're celebrities. They're on the news. Everybody loves Synanon at this point when we start. And we'll see even where that goes.
Even if you're not someone who they originally catered to because you had addiction issues, that doesn't stop them from saying, you know what? We'll just invent a new thing that you can come to and just rebrand.
The magic of cults. We'll just make a new thing. It's fine. Mm-hmm. And it shall be decreed. So that's how, if you're worried if you might be in a cult, that's how you know.
Cults are the OGs of rebranding. No mm-hmm. one knows how to do it better than a cult. So I'm Christy.
I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. Synanon's popularity grew, both from media attention and word of mouth. A new group of people became interested in the group's unconventional way of treatment. Synanon residents called people who had no history with drugs, squares. With all the positive press, many squares were eager to join the group. In 1966, game clubs sprung up around the country, with over 3,000 players joining in. For just a penny a month, anybody could meet up and use the game to work through their feelings. What seemed benevolent was actually a powerful recruiting tool to reach a wealthier, more middle-class membership. According to The Light on Synanon, players at the game clubs were lured in with the cheap monthly rates. Then, they would be invited back to Synanon for meals and to visit other facilities. They would receive invitations to so many social events on site that eventually their calendars would be filled with Synanon activities. Residents then encouraged the squares to sever ties with old friends and become part of Synanon. Chuck began filling Synanon's ranks with middle-class educated squares who had more assets to give, rather than the formerly addicted residents who had helped build the group.
And that's how we start to see what Chuck is really excited mm-hmm. about. Because at first he was really excited about actually helping people. And then I think as the money grew, he's like, well, when you join, give us every penny you have. And if someone who's like, I've been on heroin since I was 15 years old and I'm now 35 and I have nothing to show for it, I have nothing to give but my time and myself. He's like, oh, okay, that's cool, I guess. But my friend over here has never really done drugs, and they actually have an IRA that's worth $300,000 that they're willing to give to the club, but they've never done drugs, and it's like, they can come. Let them, you know what? Everyone can join.
Everyone's welcome, whether you've been a square, which, kind of rude.
Yeah, right? Hey.
I've always heard of that term as, like, you know, somebody that's boring.
This bar sucks. The squares are all here. And it's like, and I'm the one that they're pointing at. And they're like, oh.
You mean the people that don't abuse drugs? Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's boring, then so be it. But they did have more money. And I like to think Chuck had good intentions when it all began. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, with so many leaders that eventually become like a cult leader, it's the money. It's the money and the power that mm-hmm. brings everybody down. They get a taste of it. And when you never had it, and then you have a lot of it, it's real hard to go back to where you came from.
No, for sure. And I think realizing that the donations and that's all well and good, but when you really do need people that are going to be your lawyer, like run things for you, you have to have people that have gone to school. If you want to have people that are going to run a school within your community, you have to have someone who's trained to do that. So therefore mm-hmm. he's like going out and recruiting these people. But the penny a month is genius, because then it's like, oh, it's like kind of like therapy for free, but not realizing you're like a frog in a pot and they just like lure you more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like we talked about in the last episode, that Chuck Palahniuk book where the rich people like to get their kicks, go hang out with the unhoused and the poor community. And it's like, don't appropriate this into something that's like, you know, voyeuristic and just something that you want to like say you're a part of, because the foundation of this is to really help people that are struggling with addiction work through something.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got all these people coming in that don't have that battle.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got a room full of like people that are struggling with heinous addiction, and then people that are just there because they want to yell at people and get out mm-hmm. some feelings, that creates a totally different dynamic, because you can't relate now like you could to everyone before.
Yeah, and you're right, because his whole purpose at the beginning was that it is, he said, addicts helping addicts. You know, people who have been there who can help you detox or whatever. But if it's just someone who there's like, oh, I've never done that, I don't really know how to help, then it's like, well, now we're all just like screaming at each other without like an underlying purpose other than this like emotional catharsis. You're right.
Which in that case, and just like we said in the last one too, like it's kind of like Fight Club, but with words. I think if you want to have like this squares thing, it's got to be its own thing.
Yeah, separate.
So you got the square group and then you got the original resident group. So they still feel like it's a safe space for them and not all these like outsiders that they haven't bonded with and gone through these things with. Now just kind of come in and steamroll it.
No, I think you're right, though, that he liked the power to run all of it and was like, everybody in one bucket, it doesn't matter, shut up. Because really, we start to see the purpose is not really to heal anybody, but to make money.
Line the pockets, yeah.
Sinisterhood will be right back. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know what? Sometimes my social battery gets low and I didn't know what to do about it, but thankfully I was able to talk to my therapist who I found on BetterHelp about how I can say no easier because I'm a people pleaser who doesn't say no. And that gets me into trouble.
That's why you're starting an OnlyFans called Horsehead Ladybody because you and your social battery is going to be drained in more than one ways because you just like to give the people what they want.
It's true. I have to say no better, and now I can. I'm more equipped to it thanks to my my therapist.
Well, it's easy to ignore our own social batteries and spread ourselves thin, especially when it comes to social gatherings, picking up after the winter, the weather's nice, everybody's having parties, wanting to go to like rooftop patios and stuff like that. And sometimes you're like, that sounds great, but I kind of just want to chill at home and binge Love is Blind.
Right. And that's the beauty of therapy is it gives you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. My therapist, Nikki, I met on BetterHelp, and we talk every week on BetterHelp, and she has given me skills, a scale that I can use of like, do I want to go? Do I not want to go? And helped me feel less guilty about saying no, because taking care of me is also productive. It's also being kind to myself. So I just needed to talk it out and hear that.
We got to be kind to ourselves before we can be kind to others. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try.
BetterHelp is convenient, flexible, affordable, and entirely online. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/sinister today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, .com/sinister. Not wanting the residents to leave the facility and lose out on his free labor, Chuck invited them to bring their children to live with the group as well. In 1966, two residents, Al and Nina Bowman, opened the first Synanon school in a house just down the beach from the Santa Monica Armory. All Synanon children lived at the school and were raised community style, with a group of moms taking turns caring for them, known as demonstrators. Most parents saw their children, on average, once per week. I can't imagine a world in which I only saw Ella and Simon once per week. And I know that there are families where that is how it is for whatever reason. These kids were forced into a situation they had no say over and just taken from their parents. I mean, these mega daycares called hatcheries, like they're chickens.
Yeah, they called them the hatchery. Chuck said parents are really responsible for trauma that gets inflicted on kids. So parents should not be around their kids. They should be raised together communally. On the one hand, you have some people that were there from early ages that have, when they were in Santa Monica, really good memories of it. They're like, it was on the beach every day, having fun. But then as they sort of talk themselves through it, they say, you know, I never really got held when I needed it. Yeah, I really didn't feel like there was a safe place for me to cry and be with my, you know, anybody. Because these people were all, like you said, kind of just babysitters. One lady did say, she's like, I was one of the nursing moms, so I breastfed my child. And then there were five other children that I breastfed. And that was, we didn't see that that was weird. We didn't think there was anything strange about that. But Chuck sort of said around 6-7 months old, it's time to give the babies to the hatchery because he didn't want the parents to create too strong a bonds or have the kids to have too strong a bonds because he thought it led to trauma. Meanwhile, his own daughter's like, my dad never said he loved me until I was 17 years old. And you're like,
craving maybe. That attention and words of affirmation. I mean, that's something that children need. It's not just like they want it and they're being babies and literal babies crying. Like,
yeah.
They have to learn how to self-soothe and be cared for. And like, but there's studies that show like babies that aren't held and are rejected. Like, just the damage that does emotionally to them as they grow older and how they are able to handle emotions and interact with others. It's just, he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah.
And this, I already didn't like the guy. And now, like, that he when anybody brings kids into the picture, I immediately am like, just fuck you. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. If you want to fuck your own life up or make this decision to go into this treatment center, that's cool. But when you involve a minor who has no say over it, and yes, I think that for a lot of them, it was great. On the other hand, you're leaving your 7-month-old with someone who may or may not be currently using heroin and just saying, okay, I hope this goes well and bouncing.
Yeah. The video footage, they would take videos and take photos of the kids to send to the parents. Because the other thing was the parents would get assigned to a Synanon facility at another location and couldn't say no. So your kids going to the school in Santa Monica, you will be working at the Detroit location. And you're like, oh. So then they would send pictures and videos. And so you have footage of them saying, wave at the camera. Your mommy and daddy can see that you're growing up. Wave at the camera. So I think for some of them, it probably is coping to be now older and go, you know, we had a great time in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
They were later shifted, which we'll get to later, to another location where things were not even close to as great. But it still has that damaging effect of being separated. But Chuck thought it was a huge success because they would test the kids' IQ. And the children at Synanon had demonstrably higher IQ than kids in regular public schools. The Synanon kids were, when they were not playing the game, were being taught like Montessori style. It was like kid-led learning. When the kids showed interest in a piano, they would teach them piano. They would also have them do strange hours-long in studies, they called them, where they would say, okay, how does chalk stay on a blackboard? Work together and figure it out. So then they're like figuring out, okay, what's chalk made of? What's a blackboard made? So that part, I got no problem with that. They should go home to their parents at the end of the night, though.
Yeah.
You know?
And be loved.
Yes.
And have a safe place to land.
It's not just IQ. And if they want to cry. Yeah.
If they want to cry, they're not shamed for that.
Closed in a room.
And yeah. And they're not screamed at by their peers, like horrible things. I mean, none of that is something that I agree with. And it honestly gives Scientology.
Yeah.
Like the whole like separating from your parents and you should each like be your own person. And it's like, there's a time for that. But like when they're little babies, that's the time to nurture them and their kids. And they got to learn like how to navigate the world successfully. And if their parents aren't equipped to do that, okay, great. Somebody else steps in. But when the methods are very controversial and confrontational, that's where I start to have a lot of problems with it.
Yeah. And you're right. And none of the things that you just listed, none of that's measured with IQ. But for him, he was like, he was all about productivity. Oh, we're making really smart people who would be really good workers when they grow up and they can work for Synanon Industries. This is great. Right. They're all so smart. Meanwhile, the kids are like, can I get a fucking hug?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, many say that emotional intelligence is much more important than your IQ. It's your success in life. At the peak of Synanon, 250 children called the organization's dormitories home, some as young as 6 months. Unfortunately for the kids, the crux of the Synanon schooling was the game. Played with just as much vitriol and intensity as with adults, kids playing the game were forced to yell, scream, swear, and berate one another until they were reduced to tears or plugging their ears to drown out the abusive language. Deborah Schwartz was just a baby when her parents David and Janet Schwartz joined Synanon. When Deborah was 6, her parents divorced due to the group's new rules on marriage. Chuck would later declare that married couples must break up and take new partners. Typically, most children Deborah's age would be upset about their parents splitting up. However, Deborah told the LA Times that she wasn't bothered.
Oh, it didn't change my life.
This sad reality stemmed from the fact that Synanon children rarely saw their parents. Still, Deborah told the LA Times that one of her most painful memories as a child at Synanon was longing for her parents after a demonstrator disciplined her. She recalled to the publication,
I would rock myself and say in a sing-song voice, mommy and daddy, take me away.
Forced to play the game, Deborah told interviewers that it was
a good way to learn to speak your mind,
while also admitting
it was very confrontational and scary.
Heartbreaking to think of a six-year-old kid, I mean, that's Ella's age, just longing for someone to give her a hug and say it's okay and feel like she's in a safe space to cry. Mm-hmm. You can be the smartest kid in the world, but if all you want at the end of the day is your parents to, like, come give you a big hug.
Mm-hmm. That's what one of the guys said in the Synanon fix on HBO Max. He said, I just felt like there wasn't that home base, like where, you know, when you might be at a babysitter playing, but you always know that's the person that always wants to hug you and will always be there for you. And this whole hatchery situation, every demonstrator in the world is not going to take that place of that parent, you know, that home base. So, yeah, Deborah, this interview echoes what a lot of, I think, children that were raised in Synanon kind of say about it, which is like, to be fair, it wasn't all bad. I learned a few things. I don't know. None of them were like, I wouldn't change a thing. They're right. All like, well, these parts were okay. It was really heinous and horrible. And this part was terrible. And so it's like almost like they're coping with it.
Yeah. And those are just the ones that have spoken about their experiences. I mean, 250 kids in a situation like that. The mind reels. I mean, I don't think any of us would be surprised to find out the most heinous of things had happened.
Yeah.
And I hope that it wasn't the norm for most of them.
Yeah, I think for most of them at the hatchery in Santa Monica, aside from the disciplining and playing the game, there was not evidence of, no one's come out and said there were physical abuse. It was just isolation and the screaming at one another, which is
emotional, mental abuse.
Yeah.
In 1968, Synanon expanded its property holdings in Marion County, California, seeking the space to build a larger, more communal living environment. At the same time, Chuck stopped the goal of graduation for members of the drug rehabilitation program. Instead, those who achieved sobriety were meant to stay with the group indefinitely in what Chuck called a
lifetime rehabilitation program.
In an interview for the book Licit and Illicit Drugs, Chuck later explained,
we once had the idea of graduate. This was a sop to social workers and professionals who wanted me to say we were producing graduates. I've always wanted to say to them, a person with this fatal disease will have to live here all of his life. I know damn well if they go out of Synanon, they are dead.
That was the message Chuck pushed on the residents. If you leave Synanon, you will die. I think this is another reason he wants to form a religion so he can stop having people graduate. And now it's just a religion. So everyone kind of like, you know, you don't graduate from a religion. Mm-hmm. You're just a member of the religion indefinitely.
Exactly. There's not like, and I'm done now. I've learned and I can go out on my own, which is a very different thing from before when he called them the kids and he and the other woman who acted like mom and dad, and they said, we want you to save up and get a car and get a place of your own. Yeah. By 1968, it was like, you want to leave here? You'll fucking die. And that was the message I even got from like the movie, which made sense that post 1965, the squares are all wanting to join because it does look like this big, beautiful family at the end. And pretty much the implicit message of that whole movie is you can't make it on your own. If you try to go out, you will relapse. You absolutely will die. And only Chuck can save you. And that's the message he wanted because he needed bodies working the factory lines for him.
Yeah. Yeah. You want everyone to stay there under your thumb. And I mean, obviously we know that millions of people that are recovering from addiction live wonderful lives by themselves and are completely capable of that. Mm-hmm. So to, again, like psychologically abuse these people by saying like, you'll die if you go out there. You'll never amount to anything without me. Well, it takes away from like, well, what's all this work that I've been doing, this personal growth that I've been trying to find, if not to like better myself and be able to take care of myself on my own.
Yeah. And it's just that, like you said, cults are the OGs at rebranding. It's that rebranding of, we're going to make you a sober person and you can live a productive life. And then just a few, literally 10 years later is like, if you ever leave here, you'll die. I know what we said before, but actually we've learned new information. It's like, fucking make up your mind.
Yeah. Synanon called this era Synanon 2, with the goal of creating a utopian society. Synanon 1, its first iteration, had been a therapeutic community known for its drug rehabilitation goals. Spurred to action by the assassinations of both John and Bobby Kennedy, as well as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Chuck convinced the group members that the tenets of Synanon could help everyone, not just dope fiends. Famed psychologist Abraham Maslow was impressed with Synanon in these days, writing a letter to the group in 1968, saying,
"Seems to me that Synanon is now the only functioning total utopia or Eupsychian subculture in the United States." And that's in Synanon literature, the end of graduation and this kind of move up towards Northern California is like the second era. And it sort of became for the squares. Chuck would say, Synanon is a better way to live. This is, you know, you see society is crumbling. 1968 was a very tumultuous time. By then, you know, all these assassinations had happened. And he's like, we are reinventing it. Like, this is a better, you're going to get on the, I think the phrase was the ground floor of a dynamic and growing corporation. So he wasn't even like hiding it at this point. Mm-hmm. It was like, make better money.
He called them lifestyle, lifestylers. So it is like morphing into this, well, this is a lifestyle type of thing. Mm-hmm. Almost like an MLM. Or, you know, like a wellness group versus what it actually started out as. But everybody, especially, you know, middle class people back then, everybody wants to be like on the breaking ground, like cutting edge of what's going to be the new hip thing. So it's a draw for sure.
Yeah. And especially if you're despondent over the Vietnam War, you're despondent over politics, over the civil rights issues. And it's like, this is a place where everybody's kind to each other. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge on the outside. It seems like they are. It's an integrated society. So we don't have racism within the ranks because look, the leader himself is a white man married to a black woman. Like we're very progressive. I can see absolutely why people would be like, oh, I can go here. I automatically get a job. I automatically have a place to live. I automatically have friends. If you're feeling despondent, I can see why you get sucked in for sure.
Definitely.
Sinisterhood will be right back.
By 1968, the group had over 800 members. They still held some operations in Santa Monica, with many located inside Club Casa del Mar, a building that formerly housed a posh beachfront hotel. With extreme interest in the group from people without substance use issues, Chuck devised a new way for squares to participate without having to live on site. Those who maintained jobs and lives outside Synanon but still wanted to fully join could become what Chuck called a lifestyler. All or most of their income earned from outside jobs would be turned over to the group. Lifestylers also made large donations to support the Synanon cause, including inheritances, entire businesses, and one building that covered an entire city block in San Francisco. One woman, Dorothy Salant Garrett, gave the group $1 million.
And that's what one guy was like, yeah, I joined the group and then my dad died and my mom had already passed away. And so I inherited my parents' retirement accounts and their houses. And I was like, what should I do with it? And Chuck and the Synanon group was like, you should give it to Synanon because we're the new utopia. And by giving us your money, you're helping make society a better place. And it was like, oh, you're right. And he's like, I wrote him a check for $50,000 and I wrote him the deed to my parents' house. And you're like, what? But I think
you're grieving.
You're desperate. Yeah.
You both, your parents are gone. You're alone. Mm-hmm. You have people that are like, you could be a hero. This is just what we need. You know, I mean, it plays on all your vulnerabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Synanon, they're like, ring that register, baby. We're making money.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Though the organization was registered as a nonprofit called the Synanon Foundation, that entity was financially supported by the corporate arm called Synanon Industries, the holding company for the group's various businesses. A large majority of revenue came from AdGap, a Synanon business that customized pins, hats, jackets, and more with business logos. It generated profits of over $1 million in its first year, powered by employees working only for room and board. Food was donated to the group, as was medical and dental care from faithful Synanon doctors and dentists. Full-time residents worked light manufacturing or retail sales jobs by day, supporting Synanon-owned businesses, attended game sessions by night, and spent all their free time with one another.
And yeah, for if you wanted to run a corporation as a CEO and you could get all your employees to live on site, there's zero commute, they don't ever call in sick because you know if they're sick or not because they live with you, and you don't have to worry about them asking for raises because they work for you, and if you get pissed at them, you can make them shave their head, you'd probably really like that. And we don't live in a world like that. That's actually much worse than the society we live in, which is already pretty exploitive of workers.
Yeah, and when everyone is spending all their time together day and night, it creates this toxic bubble where, and that's what any cult leader wants, right? Mm-hmm. For everyone to be in this bubble so you're not getting like outside information or outsiders' opinions. Like, are you sure that that's what you want to be doing? Because it seems like they kind of are trying to scam people. No one's going to say that in the group. So then it's like, cut all those people off, sever ties with everyone outside of this.
No, it's true. And I feel like Chuck was still, his prior pre-Synanon, pre-TLC, because he was in PR and sales, he still sold the Synanon Foundation. And to him, he would just go, oh, well, the Synanon Industries, that's just how we help people. We need the money. We just need the money. Not, I need the money to take and put in my own bank account, which he was doing. It was, we really need this money because the more people we have working for us and the more money we have, the more dope fiends we can help. And it wasn't true. It just started becoming that bit, I won't say business, but the arm that was the rehabilitation focus shrunk almost down to nothing. But he still publicly was promoting, oh, the businesses, because they would have like CBS would come out and interview them and would want to do a walkthrough of the AdGap facilities of like, how are you making all these pins? And he's like, we have so many good workers and these people were living on the streets and now they have a job and isn't Synanon great? So then you're technically running like a legit, like a regular business, but then you're getting corporations to send you more money and random Joe Schmoes who are watching the news going, oh, he is helping all those poor people on the streets. I'm going to send him some money too. It was just all
meanwhile,
PR.
None of that money goes to the residents and the people that are working as far as a paycheck goes. Not maybe really, they get better food, but I mean, their living conditions are still the same living conditions. So you're working harder, more money's coming in. In most jobs, that would mean, okay, then I get a raise so I can improve my own personal situation. And that wasn't the case. It was like, you're working for room and board. Well, okay, then where's all this money and donations going? If you're not paying the people that are working for you, you're just putting it in your own bank account.
Yeah, he's like, well, we have to expand. We have to buy more property. We have to buy, don't you think we need a helicopter so we can get around? And I need several boats. And it's like, okay, well, but he was good at selling, and you really couldn't question him on account of his fucking terrible attitude and personality. Yeah. You could not
No, he was one of those people that you didn't want to get into it with because he was such a bulldog. Yeah, and so like abrasive that you just kind of like gave up because you didn't want to listen to him. The drug rehabilitation efforts were increasingly deprioritized in favor of building an alternative lifestyle community. However, they continued the drug treatment efforts to attract contributions and to maintain the group's tax-exempt charitable status. The so-called dope fiends became resentful of Chuck's attention on the new lifestylers. They confronted their savior at a game session in Santa Monica in 1968. On a recording of the meeting, Chuck can be heard calling those who helped him build his now empire,
"Lousy, rotten, filthy bums! You aren't worth anything!"
Those who came for their substance use issues were upset at Chuck's shifting priorities and began to leave, just before things turned violent.
And I think he would really berate people that challenged him and really reward people that were like, yes, Chuck, you're right, Chuck. Everything's so great, Chuck. And those people would get maybe not financially rewarded, but get rewarded with like promotions. They get to be in charge of people. They get to be the ones running, you know, events or whatever. And
the inner circle. Yeah, you're just more circle. Liked by the mm-hmm. leader. I mean, that's a good feeling for most people.
You end up on the board of directors or whatever, mm-hmm. which someone said the board of directors was Chuck, Betty, his wife, Chuck's daughter, Chuck's son, Chuck's brother, and then all the people that gave as much money, like all the people that gave the most money. So if you're like the lady that gave $1 million, the person that gave the entire city block building in San Francisco, those people would become. And so then you're there as a person who was struggling with addiction. You're like, I've spent my life day in, day out here, and I haven't gotten, like, all of a sudden this person gives somebody a building and they get to be on the board and I don't. I can imagine mm-hmm. you'd be real pissed. You're like, I was down in the original location. They got fucking condemned and bulldozed, eating peanut butter sandwiches, chain smoking with this asshole. And now all of a sudden I'm a filthy, rotten bum that doesn't do anything for you. Fuck you. Yeah. And then, yeah.
For sure. Fuck you. By 1969, in addition to the California locations, Synanon had expanded to New York, Texas, and Michigan. That year, Chuck and Betty moved north from Santa Monica to the Synanon-owned properties in West Marin County, California. Wherever Chuck and Betty went became the group's headquarters. And soon, over 1,000 residents moved to the small, unincorporated area in Marin County known as Tamales Bay. The entire sprawling facility was built from the ground up with Synanon labor. Free labor.
Mm-hmm. And he would just go, I believe we need a large building. And everyone's like, all right, let's do it. Who's digging the foundation? Who's doing this? I mean, they would jump. You have that many people that are willing to just jump and go. And also, mm-hmm. you didn't really even get to say, I would love to help. They would be like, okay, Mike, you're on the construction crew now. You'll be digging 5 hours a day. And then you can have a 30-minute break, and then you'll be digging 5 more hours. And they would have to be like, okay. Like, you didn't go, oh, no, thanks. I don't want to get transferred north. So people, again, would get transferred away from their kids or their families or people they were hanging out with, and it was not questioned.
And most of us, after work, get to go home and have a break from our coworkers and be with our family and be in our own, like, sanctuary, and then kind of regroup and mm-mm. recharge for the next day of work. But these people had to go right back to and live with their boss, essentially, and all their coworkers. So any issues you had with anybody were constant. You never got a break from it. You know what I mean? And that would drive me bananas. I got to have a break from everybody. I got to have my alone time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I always have to, like, recharge, you know, nobody can be with somebody all the time. That would drive you bonkers.
No, for sure. And especially then once you're living there. And then also, it's not just, okay, well, it's like an apartment complex and we all have our own individual places. They had the smush room, which we weren't making that up. They called it the guest room. But then once they moved to West Marin, there was literally a woman. This is actually the same woman who was breastfeeding the children when she had her kid. She said her name's Elena Broslovsky. And she's like, yeah, I was the one that had the guest room book. And so the couples would have to come to me. So it's not just like there's a guest book and you sign in and you go in. You have to go to a lady that you work mm-hmm. with. And tell her, hello, I would please like to have sex with my husband, please.
It's got a baby on each tit.
Yeah. And she's like,
neither of them are hers. And she's like, hold on. Let me see what openings we've got today. Yeah. But like, then, nothing's private. You have no privacy.
And not even that Elena knew, because you were signing the smush book. There was a chart on the wall.
Oh, yikes.
And you put a star whenever you smushed with your spouse. And you got a smush star, and it was like not a competition, but married couples were encouraged to
not utilize. A competition, but it is a competition.
You know,
it was. You know, even if it's just amongst each other, that kind of develops into a competition.
I always say,
see how many times a week people are doing it.
Yeah. And so Christ. She's like, they would try to get like the most stars up there, because Chuck was like, you need to be having sex. Like, it wasn't like free love. Everybody was fucking each other. But he also would just point to someone and go, hey, you two work well together. You should get married now. And the people are like, oh, yeah, okay. I guess we'll get married. Like, oh, okay. Yeah. So now you're dictated. Everything's dictated.
Everything is dictated. Yes. Sinanon became the most financially successful of many communes that popped up in the 1970s, with its beautiful facilities and full residential spaces, including a dining room that fed all residents. The group owned real estate in Santa Monica, Marin County, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Reno, Detroit, New York, and Puerto Rico. In a recorded speech, Chuck expressed his intent with the Marin County compound.
"We want to provide an aesthetically pleasing, psychologically pleasing, philosophically pleasing place in which people can dwell. What am I describing? Paradise?
Hell?
Yeah. Where you have to, you can't leave your coworkers? Yikes."
I mean, for so long, so many people have tried to develop a utopian society. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, it's never gone well.
Yeah, yeah. It's because I think human nature never, because if there's no leader, then people will, someone steps in to take advantage of everybody. And then always, if there is a leader, they take advantage of everyone. Yeah. So it's like.
And then usually at some point, everyone decides, okay, we're going to overthrow this leader. Mm-hmm. So there's a coup.
Always.
So it just, and I don't have an answer. I'm just saying, I don't think it, whatever we've all done since the dawn of time hasn't worked. So if somebody's got the formula for a livable, successful utopian society, hit us up. Because yeah. I'd love to live in a place like that.
I think we have to get everyone's buy-in. So everybody's just got to be cool, man, and then the whole world can be a utopian yeah. society.
And
just
I
be
mean,
fucking cool, man.
If we could all do that, then, man, war would stop.
We'd have
poverty,
world peace. Yeah, we'd everything. Have world peace. That's my wish.
That's all we got to do.
Yeah, most people are like, you want to come to my ranch and I'll show you how to live? And I'm like, I'm not interested in that.
Lifestylers were living on site, with Chuck's focus moving away from helping those he called dope fiends and instead on building Sinanon Industries, their corporate efforts to support what he called a
self-supporting organization.
At first, lifestylers who lived in the community still worked outside the community, turning over the bulk of their earnings to the group. But Chuck's concept of containment meant that all residents were encouraged to expend their energy inside the group to benefit fellow residents and grow the community, rather than waste time trying to build something on the outside. Soon that encouragement became mandatory, and the lifestylers began working only for Sinanon businesses.
And that's what everybody that went from lifestyler to full-blown resident, which is there soon was nobody that wasn't living there that was part of it, were like, mm-hmm. yeah, he would just be like, you work so hard. Don't you wish you were working hard for us? And like a lawyer who works at a law firm or the DA's office or whatever, it was like, well, we need a lawyer at Sinanon. Like instead of us taking the money that you earn and then going and paying a different lawyer, wouldn't it just be better if all of your efforts were for us? And they're like, he just made it make sense. And it was like, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't do that.
It's very manipulative. And there's so much guilt tripping too that goes on with like, look at all this that we've done for you. I mean, wouldn't you want to do that for others? Well, then we really need your assistance as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Why are you giving those efforts away when the group has given you so much? Shouldn't you give everything to the group? And the people that didn't get kicked out for going, no, we're all like, yeah, of course, you're right. And it's that frog in a pot. Like they just thought, oh, well, this is going to be for the benefit of utopia here. And we're creating this. And soon Sinanon will be so big, anybody can be part of it. And then the whole world will be free. So it was a little bit of that late 60s residual optimism, I think, too.
Yeah. There's also just zero boundaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in anyone that tries to establish a boundary of like, no, I want to come here and like scream at people, but I'm going to go home to my family and work my regular job. It was like, well, that's not allowed. So it was either you're in or you're out. There was, you know, it was Chuck's way or the highway.
Oh, yeah. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Chuck also devised The Wire, the Sinanon radio station available on special boxes that he distributed to all facilities around the country. Former resident Elena Broslovsky described the contents.
They were these little boxes that were all over the place that you could turn on, get the news, and listen to games.
It meant constant connections to every single facility, as the various facilities would chime in with updates from their states and cities. Most of the time, the wire would play audio of Chuck, meaning his voice was piped in no matter where the residents were and no matter where Chuck was. He was constantly taped, during lectures, during the game, and even while he was eating dinner. Workers would cut up the recordings and edit them into the hours of programming.
Yeah, someone was like, he didn't really say like, okay, let's go have a meeting and we're going to sit down and ideate what's going to be the next plan. That he just wanted to be recorded constantly because he would just like go on a tangent and be like, did someone write that down? And if somebody had, then he's like, damn it. So then it was just always recorded. And then it would be like, that would make a good lecture. Go back and cut that up. Like
it's
I was
like
riffing.
A reality show before reality shows.
Yeah. Or like Prince. Prince, like he had microphones in every room in his house because he would just start singing and he didn't want to. It was like pre-cell phone days, I guess. Like Taylor Swift just sings like a voice memo. But he didn't want to like miss out on a great idea. Mm-hmm. And so it was like cut it up into something. But it's a reality show that you get to control and you're like, make me look really good. Mm-hmm. Make everyone love
it,
me.
It's reminds me a lot of Jim Jones too, because his voice and his preachings were piped into, you know, the speakers at that compound were just constantly playing his voice. So you can't ever escape it. Again, like there's no respite where you can just be like, oh, a moment to myself or with my own thoughts. Like that didn't exist.
No, you can't have that because you'd be like, a moment to myself. God, I'm glad I don't have to hear Chuck's stupid ass voice. He sucks at what he does anyway. I think I'm going to quit. It's like you can't even think that. Mm-hmm. You have to just keep listening. Also, can I just say, I'm such a right over the head when she said there were these little boxes that were all over the place and you could turn it on and listen to games. I was like, baseball games? Not baseball games. It was Scream games.
Yeah, at first I also thought games and then I realized when we said he was constantly taped during lectures during the game that I was, no, it's just listening to other people scream at each other. You're not listening to the Ranger game. You're not listening to the Cowboys play. You're listening to people scream their assholes at each other.
From all over. So you could be in San Francisco and it would be like, the game is beginning in Detroit. And then it would just be people that maybe you knew some, maybe you didn't. Hollering their deep secrets and talking shit to each other. And somebody, for the person being yelled at, now not only are you on the hot seat for just the circle of people that are around you, it is for the 1,000 people, literally 1,500 people across the country now that are listening to a recording of talking shit to you about whatever your downfalls and failings are. So I would imagine the efficacy of the breakdown of the person's individuality and their own like self-respect and resilience and like anything that would help them to leave would be devastated even more because it's that many more people listening to you being shamed.
Mm-hmm. And much like with social media today, it's real easy to forget that 1,500 people are listening to you and you're just focused on like the 20 people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say a bunch of stuff and realize, oh my God, so many people that I didn't think about heard that and have copies of that now and can share that information. And, you know, so like it's what you thought was sacred and private, at least within the confines of a room, has gone out the window.
Yeah, exactly. Because it takes it from being just a little group therapy to now being like borderline entertainment for people.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely entertainment. Starting in 1970, Chuck's lectures shifted from philosophizing to mandating behaviors. The first edict seemed so outrageous it made headlines in the New York Times, which read,
"Quitting smoking, hard for addicts."
And quoted one Synanon resident saying,
"It was much easier to quit heroin than cigarettes."
Chuck told the Times the decision to require residents to quit smoking was a combination of a cloudy lung x-ray and pressure from 200 young people under 15 who lived in the community, explaining,
"They're non-smokers, so they don't have to rationalize away the medical reports and anti-smoking commercials the way I always did."
The punishment for smoking was head shaving or expulsion. It would be nice if he was having everyone quit smoking so the children weren't around this all the time. I don't think that's why he did it.
Nah, I don't think so either. I don't think it was COPD or whatever. He said it was emphysema. I don't think it was his emphysema.
No. And also, if you have a cloudy lung x-ray, like good for you for stopping smoking and taking care of yourself. But again, like, you can't force everyone else to do that just because you made that decision for yourself.
Yeah, we'll see right now. His interests weren't really in everybody's health.
I've never done heroin. I smoked for many, many years. You know, an addictive personality is an addictive personality. So you're quitting one addiction. You've got the cigarettes. And for some people that are going through that, that's like the one bright spot of their day.
Yeah.
The one saving grace that's getting them through each day. And then you take that away. And it really is like just a form of torture, but masked in this like, we're trying to do this to make you healthier.
Yeah. And also probably behavioral control to say like, I'll see who the truly strong ones are because I have told them this shall be, and they have a physiological and also psychological craving for it. No, I definitely think it's kind of a test, right? Too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chuck preached loudly on the wire that everyone should quit smoking. However, it was hard convincing residents to stop when Synanon had always provided unlimited free cigarettes. The Times reported that the group's cigarette bill was almost $200,000 a year for an unlimited supply of cigarettes for the 1,400 members across seven centers. In banning smoking, Chuck saved a ton of money, but he also changed one aspect that had been fundamental to the group. Some members left over the ban. Those who stayed would see the erosion of the other two initial markers of early Synanon, nonviolence and a ban on drugs and alcohol, disappear shortly after their cigarettes.
And that's what, even in the Synanon movie, the fake Chuck is like, one of his very first lines is, we drink a hell of a lot of coffee and we smoke a hell of a lot of cigarettes, but we care about each other and this works. And like the person comes to the Synanon boarding house and she's like, oh, there's coffee over there. There's cigarettes over there, whatever you want. So it was these kind of this trifecta of like unlimited cigarettes, nonviolence, and nobody does any drugs or alcohol. And suddenly he's like, these cigarettes are costing me a fucking arm and a leg. Shut it down. Like, shut it down. And I think that's why I think he banned it. I think there was a fiscal reason for most of the decisions that he made.
For sure. I read that he was a three-pack-a-day smoker, which, I mean, I believe it because all the footage, they are all never without a cigarette in their hand. I mean, it's, you know, just put one out, immediately light another one. If you want to say, I'm not going to supply them anymore. Okay. But to outright ban them entirely is wild.
Yeah, I think it's probably a twofer. Like, he saves $200,000 a year. And then also he's test the water of how much can I control these people's behaviors before they'll get fed the fuck up and leave.
Yeah. The punishment for breaking Chuck's rules centered around public humiliation. Deborah Schwartz spoke with the LA Times about the group's abusive tactics.
Your head was shaved and you were told to shut up and made to wear a cardboard sign around your neck that said something degrading, like, I am an idiot.
Head shaving also became a way to haze new members.
So now we're seeing it's not like the therapeutic community where only the screaming and mean things happen during the game, but the rest of the time it's very collegial. Now it's like, you shall be punished.
Mm-hmm. Also, just a fun fact, because so many of them had their head shaved, a lot of them were extras in a sci-fi film that George Lucas made back then. I think it was called THX 1388 or something.
Yeah.
Because it's this dystopian sci-fi and they all look like that's where they would belong.
Yeah. The head shaving, I think we're going to get more into part two when it sort of becomes a marker of the group. But in the early days before that, it was a punishment.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, in 1972, the Michigan legislature paid $300,000 to the group to take in multiple juvenile offenders in its West Marin location. They were classified as, quote, juvenile delinquents by the system, either for crimes or drugs. While the facilities were not open to state health inspectors, the California juvenile system and parents themselves sent dozens of kids to Synanon for treatment. Made up of youths who had already been sent to Synanon, the so-called punk squad took in the new young residents. While the kids and their parents were sold on promises of horseback rides and crafts, instead, the children as young as 9 years old were subjected to military-like treatment, physical abuse, and forced labor. eventually becoming the part-time maintenance crew for the facility.
Yeah, I think Chuck started to say, we're going to have to make some kind of money off of this if we're going to have kids around here. And because they had a location in Detroit, the Michigan legislature was like, oh, this guy came and spoke to us and told us that, you know, he does these like therapeutic things, and the same therapies that help people with substance use issues can help these juveniles with substance problems or with truancy issues. And these brochures are so lovely, and look, they're painting and they're doing crafts. And like, in reality, he was like, we got to get a flower bed around this. There's like 53 buildings out there that need flower beds. So get a shovel and start digging, kid. And it's like, oh, I thought I was here to be reformed. It was like, no, you're here to work. And if you don't work, we'll literally kick you in the ribs.
It sounds like the teen camps that still exist that are a complete nightmare and they are horribly abusive.
And they took all of Chuck's ideas from Synanon, from the Synanon school, and we'll get to this more in part three. And that's where they invented teen camps.
Starting in the 1970s, disgruntled former members began speaking out against Synanon, alleging physical and emotional abuse within the community. One story published by the San Francisco Examiner in January of 1972 called it
"The Racket of the Century."
This was the first public criticism of Synanon, and Chuck did not take kindly to it. The group sued, but the damage was done. With increasing national negative press, more lawsuits followed, and the cracks in Synanon's foundation began to spread.
They said that because up until this article, every bit of coverage of Synanon was done with Chuck's participation. He talked to him. They did interviews. It was always a very sunny, this is the man that's going to save the world. Even the school, he would, because the kids were disenfranchised, they couldn't go give interviews. So he would be like, the school and the, you know, if you send your kids here, they're going to learn so much. Their IQs are going to be so much brighter. But the San Francisco Examiner did real journalism, and he was so pissed, he sued them, and it got settled for $600,000. And this lawsuit really is what created the internal Synanon law firm. Like, it was the law firm within the group. It was a few actual lawyers who had gone to law school, but then those attorneys began training members to be legal secretaries or to study and perhaps take the bar themselves, because Chuck didn't want to have to spend money on lawyers. So he's like, we need people in-house. But he took that $600,000. He took $300,000 for himself. And then the other $300,000, he took it, and the 30 people who had been in Synanon the longest, he gave them $10,000 each as like a thank you for staying around. And I guess to show people, like, look, this, which was the largest libel settlement of all time at the time, it was in the Guinness Book of World Records, he was showing, like, look, I'm spreading the wealth. Like, bitch, you took 50% for yourself, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sinister Hood will be right back.
With pressure mounting, Synanon sought official religious status in 1974, a move seen by some as a tactic to gain legal protections. By then, 1,800 people were living on Synanon properties, with centers located in New York, Connecticut, Illinois, and Michigan. The group also owned property in Santa Monica and Oakland, including a 1,878-acre ranch in Marin County. In total, Synanon held assets worth $20 million. But by the mid-1970s, Chuck began calling for a
new religious posture
that was more violent. He began amassing guns, with Synanon eventually buying more firearms than any organization in the history of California. It wasn't long before the New York Times published an article titled
Synanon, Utopian Dream or Nightmare?
Raising questions about the group's practices. So what do we think?
Well, I love JD said to interviewers, like, oh, well, you know, some people thought it was really a church, and I never really did. I think he just did it to get to not have to pay taxes. Because really, I think they'd moved so far away from the rehabilitation. They still had kind of the kid camp part, but like, parents were paying, the legislature would pay them to take kids. Individual parents could pay to send their kids there, even if the parent wasn't going to be a part of Synanon. So now it's like, now you just run like a kid camp, and that's not really, that's not nonprofit. Mm-hmm. You registered nonprofit for this rehab, and you don't even really do that anymore.
And now you're going to register as a religion, but what are your ideologies? What's your doctrine? Like, what are y'all doing?
Yeah, he said, this is the kind of revolution that moved the world from Judaism to Catholicism to Protestantism to Synonism. This is a total revolution. And it was like, I think
he called his religion cynicism?
Synonism.
That sounds too much like cynicism.
Well, you should have some cynicism so you don't join Synonism. Because
that's what I'm saying.
The problem is,
to name it something that sounds so close to something that has a negative connotation is a bit silly.
It's like, listen, man, that's already a word. But yeah, the question was like, did they call themselves Sinanites? Kind of like a Mennonite or a...
Cynics?
Yeah, they're just like, this is a new religion. And he tried to kind of say, well, you don't have to give up if you're Jewish or Catholic or anything like that. It's an add-on. It's just... You know, a little, it's like a protein boost.
You get your smoothie and then you add a little protein boost. You can be whatever you want. And then you're also, you got some cynicism on top of it.
Yeah. And then I don't have to, and then I don't have to pay taxes. So everybody join up. But I think that it was pretty, in my opinion, fairly transparent. But this is just and that's what they call Synanon 3, which is episode 3 will be about. As we'll move into that and what happens after it becomes a religion. But this whole utopian society, I think it's only really utopian if you're in charge of it, it sounds like.
Yeah, if you're the leader or you have donated a ton of money and are on the good list in the inner circle. For everyone else, it sounds like you're working your ass off for the bare minimum.
Yeah, and I mean, he, in later court documents, he acknowledged this time during the late 1960s, early 1970s, when they were really blowing and going with the assets and the businesses. They had a bunch of gas stations. They had all, like, entire businesses would get donated to Synanon, and then that person would obviously join the board of directors. But that's a whole other going concern and operation that then he can staff out with Synanon residents. And it was this huge conglomeration of businesses. He acknowledged that his family got a couple million bucks. Like it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to live amongst you all and we're going to have, you know, like we had with our peanut butter sandwiches. People lived in the dorms. The people ate the food from the cafeteria. Chuck was not doing that. He kept the money. He kept, like I said, half of that settlement. And I think it was just like, for him, he got to be a CEO of a business that he built, which is fine, unless the business is built on coerced, forced labor and fraud, which is what I think we're seeing here, just under the guise of a utopia.
Truly, yeah. What started out perhaps with good intentions quickly became just something filled with greed and power, and like you said, transparent. It seems so transparent that it's almost, I have like secondhand embarrassment for him that he thinks he's pulling one over on everybody, because it's like, dude, everybody sees what you're doing here.
Yeah, but it's wild how effective his marketing and PR was, especially up until that San Francisco Examiner article. How progressive and positive he seemed, especially with regards to education, because around the late 1960s, there was a big push against public education. Parents saw it as stifling. They thought it was kind of outdated, outmoded. And the ideas of things like Montessori school, which is a great thing. Your kid goes to Montessori school. That's great. Well, when he's like, it's sort of like a Montessori school, but it's free. All you have to do is kind of come like work here too. That, as a middle-class parent, one of the dads got interviewed and was like, my wife was fine with it. And I was like, I don't want to be away from the kids. I don't think it's right that we're away from the kids. And she was like, you just need to trust this man as a genius. And he had built such a reputation from 1958 to 1968 being like heralded as a revolution. Abraham Maslow's writing him a letter saying like, you are the like Eusykian utopia that we all wanted. So people that would otherwise be hard to recruit are very willing to hand their children over because the messaging was so powerful. And not only that, he had traditional media backing him because nobody was really digging into nothing until these folks in at the San Francisco Chronicle. And in part three, we'll talk about this little bitty tiny newspaper that made a real big splash on the whole story. And much like everything, it's journalists that kicked the door open.
For real. And much like so many things, he might be a genius to these parents and stuff, but these kids that are shipped off to these things that have no say in it whatsoever, and then there's nobody checking into this. They're just failed by so many systems because no one man should be allowed to like run this teen boot camp mm-hmm. with the punk squad that he called them and make them work and have them participating in the game. Mm-hmm. And there's no regulations over it.
No. No. And the kids that came out of it would, it's the things you would expect of like, I said no and I was hit or whatever, you know, things like mm-hmm. that, where when the parents read the brochures, they don't think that, oh, my kid's actually never going to get to do any of this stuff. It's all going to just be whatever can help Chuck, which he's like, we need people to mow lawns. Kids can mow lawns. Let them do that. And it mm-hmm. wasn't, this will be good for them because they're tending a garden. It was just like, well, I don't know. The legislator gave us a couple $100,000. Like, let's go have him do it. I don't think he gave a shit about kids. He didn't like them, kids. He didn't like his own kids. He wasn't around them. Yeah, he wasn't around his own kids.
Didn't tell his own kids he loved him. Yeah, and he also was barely around him. JD had to join the whole group to even like get some time with their dad.
Like be around him. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And so I think he, and it's much like anything, he doesn't take responsibility. And when the shit hits the fan, he doesn't even come to the aid of his own family. It's all about Chuck. And so we'll see in part three, it gets to be really, really, really all about Chuck to where blood is drawn.
Blood is drawn. Well, tune in next week for I don't know if it's an exciting conclusion, but
it's a roller coaster ride.
It's a roller coaster conclusion.
Unexpected things. There's a book I got that I can't recall what it's called, but it's the Synanon, you know, kind of an overview book. Oh, it's called The Rise and Fall of Synanon, A California Utopia. And I, you know, when you read it, you're kind of like, who is this guy? What's your relationship to the group? I have one book that's by one of the journalists that blew the lid off, one book that's by a lawyer that represented a lot of people. This one, I was like, the guy goes, this was a great group, though there were times when things did get a bit crazy. Just remember that quote as you listen for next time. See if you would describe what we're going to talk about in part three as a bit crazy.
Our weekend was a bit crazy. Yes. And you can learn more about that on 420. But
yeah,
I would probably use stronger words to describe what happens
would
here.
So would the enforcement authorities of the government and the federal for authorities sure. would too. So yeah, well, stay tuned for things to get a little bit crazy in part three. And yeah, come hang out with us on that live stream on 420 at 2 p.m. Central. It's going to be a hoot and a holler.
Hoot and even a though holler. I know, I'm so bummed.
I think you should leave live in Dallas, Fort Worth, Scott. So canceled, and I'm so sad.
I can't tell you how excited I was to go to that on 420. I've been looking forward to it for fucking months, and they just today was like, oh, this is canceled. There's not really an explanation. It's just your tickets will be refunded. But what's crazy is all of the other shows are fine still.
Yeah, so, it said an unforeseen scheduling conflict. Someone on Reddit said they called the arena and they go, the promoters just called and said there was a scheduling conflict and it's canceled and to do refund. So sorry. So Tim Robinson and Zach Cannon, you owe me.
Well, if it's truly a, you know, something that you can't help, that's one thing. If it's like, we didn't sell as many tickets as we'd like, so now we're going to have a scheduling conflict and cancel it.
Or they're like, it's 420.
I was going to be there front and center. And cheering you on the whole
literally,
time.
Literally, yeah. Maybe it was just because it was 420 and they're like, we're not going to spend it in Texas. So no right. shame. If I mean, that's the case, fair. I forgive you. Never mind.
Like,
you owe
wait
me nothing.
A second. It's 420 and we're going to one of the states that doesn't allow you to buy weed. We have a scheduling conflict. So suddenly we'll be doing this show in Colorado.
Yeah, we're going to stay in LA because fuck you guys. And in that case, you owe me nothing and I forgive you.
Yeah. Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can join for free to see what we're up to next or dive into over 800 hours of bonus content.
I've got a special bonus content for you all this week. We have an Oops All Updates True Crime Headlines where it is multiple updates on probably like 6 or 7 cases we've covered before. There's been some wild things in the news, some things that I didn't even hear about. And I just was like, I'm going to go find some updates for y'all. So be sure to tune in on Patreon for that coming later this week.
Yeah, there's one of the girls convicted in the Slender Man attack way back when is now asking to be let out. There's
have info on Cherry Papini. I have something on the Kaufman County DA killer. I can't even list them all off. There's like I said, like 6 or 7 in there. So we'll bring that to you at the end of the week.
If you just want to sign up for free, we release once a month an archived bonus content. So you still get some fun content, or you can do a free trial where you can join at any tier. So even the highest tier, check out all of the perks. And as long as you cancel any time before the week trial period is up, you won't get charged. Or if you decide, I really like what I'm seeing here, so I want to stick around, then we'd love for you to do that too.
Honestly, doing a free trial the week of a Q&A is probably the best idea, because you get to go to the Q&A, the 420 Q&A of all days. And if you, like you said, if you don't want to stay, you can quit, or you stick around and you can check out our ad-free episodes, our quarterly bonus content live stream. We got one of those coming up for you with the date to be announced soon. The weekly bonus content, including true crime headlines, monthly minisodes. We got a new one of those coming for you, and merch discounts. So you can get 10 to 20% off all of your purchases in our store. Plus you get to hang out with the best listeners on the whole internet. We love y'all.
Truly, truly, truly we do. And for recent patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show, and make sure you stick around after our sign-offs to hear your shout-out.
Head over to sinisterhood.com, click shop on the top banner to check out merch like t-shirts, mugs, totes, stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos. I have seen so many adorable kids wearing our Believe and Be Kind Flatwoods Monster shirt. So cute. And not only that, you can get one for yourself to match your little ones. And don't forget to check out our merch clearance sale. We got a lot of stuff deeply discounted, and you can use your Patreon merch discount on there as well. So go get yourself a deal.
Go treat yourself.
Treat yourself.
Treat yourself. While you're on our website, you can also review the show. We make it super simple for you to leave us a review. We love ones that are 5-star, like anybody, like a fine restaurant. Everybody likes a 5-star review, right? You can also follow us on socials and check out the episode description for sources used during our research. You'll also find fun things like topic-based playlists and links to live show tickets.
You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Watch full video versions of the show early and ad-free on Patreon, and free to everybody a few days later on YouTube. We've got longer clips of Freaky Friday over on our TikTok channel. We're also just a few days away from going live on TikTok at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in West Virginia. So be sure you are following us on TikTok at Sinisterhood Podcast so that you'll catch us when we go live, because we don't know when we'll go live, because we get an overnight visit. So who knows what time it'll be, including our UK.
We're on the ghost time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, something happens, we go live. Like, we don't know when they're going to make contact.
No, we're going to be in there from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. So it can be any time in there. And we'll
maybe
also
multiple times.
Yeah. We'll have a cool video for you afterwards that will go up on our YouTube channel. Speaking of videos, if you want us to make a video for you, check us out on Cameo. Cameo is where you can order custom video shout outs, have a say happy birthday, happy anniversary, happy 420, happy Earth Day, whatever you want from us and the menagerie of fun characters that we have in the studio, including Sir Garthur Brooks, the Popple, McGruff. I gestured off screen because he's right there. Our Blucifer hat, which I also, it's not a hat, it's a full fucking head of a horse.
It's a mascot head.
It's a mascot head of Blucifer. So whatever
if
you want.
If you went into a movie theater, they wouldn't be like,
no,
ma'am, can you remove your hat?
No, I would be not allowed to get a ticket. Because they would be like, a horse is trying to buy a ticket with a lady body. And that's me, horse head with a lady body. Cameo.com, search Sinisterhood. Where are you at on the internet?
I'm on Instagram and Threads at Christy M. Wallace. And I'm on TikTok at Christy or GTFO. Heather, where are you?
My OnlyFans is horse head lady body. And the rest of my stuff online is at Heather versus the World.
Oh, man. I would bet $10 that there is an OnlyFans called Horsehead Ladybody, and it's going to get a couple new followers now.
It's
going to
just be
you.
Me with the head, and then I'll just wear like a bathing suit because I'm not.
Oh,
going
you're
going to
get. There's definitely people that will subscribe.
And then just dance, just and that's it. And it's just hours of me with a horse head and the body. That's how I'm going to go live on TikTok. On my page. Like, I'm not going to curse the show page. I'll just
go
on my own.
Where is Heather? Because we got to record, and Paris like, she's dancing again.
She's gone live. She's gone live, and it's just me wearing the Blucifer head and the lady body, because that's what I have, and just dancing. So find that at Heather versus the World across social media.
Yeah, please don't sleep on that. As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Hey, everybody. everybody, thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shoutouts. Laura Turner.
Julia.
Jennifer Garland.
Drew.
Hannah.
Yolanda Serrato.
Nikki Cole.
AJ Dunn.
Jaws. The shark from Jaws?
Yeah, the shark from Jaws. He's the patron now. So is Kayla King.
Eve.
Allie McClure.
And Sasha.
Thank you so much for joining our Patreon. We could not do this without you. We sincerely love and appreciate every single one of you. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Horse head lady body coming to you soon.